Few aspects of early Americana are more fascinating than the lives of New England whalers and the creatures they hunted. Ships would sail into the Atlantic and beyond to find whales, kill them, and convert their blubber into oil that could be used for lighting lamps. It was one of the most dangerous occupations of the time, but the only way that most people today learn much about it is to read Moby Dick. Rick Burns sheds new light on this old story with his latest documentary called Into the Deep, America, Whaling, and the World. Premieres tonight on PBS, and I'm very pleased that it brings Rick Burns back to our show today. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
So how did whaling start in this country? There must have been whaling before people came here.
There was. The Basques had kind of invented, pioneered, quote, modern whaling 1,000 years ago and more. But between the Basques and the Dutch and the English, they'd basically fished out the right whale population along the European shore by the 16th century.
And what were they using the whales for? Not for
they
oil.
They used the bones in architecture. They did use the oil as a kind of a lamp oil. They've used the baleen. There are two kinds of whales, toothed whales like sperm whales and baleen whales who instead of teeth have these long fronds of cartilage hanging from their upper jaws, which is kind of a plastic substitute or a plastic before plastic. When you heat it up, it'll take a shape and hold it when it cools down. So that was used in all sorts of applications.
Like stays.
Like later, umbrella stays and corset stays and basically anything we would today use plastic for, baleen came to be used for.
And some people also eat whale, don't they?
You know, the Europeans did, and in fact the Pope in the 15th, 16th century decreed that it was safe to eat whale meat on Fridays because they were thought to be cold-blooded, not warm-blooded, and therefore wouldn't arouse libidinous passions. Americans, interestingly, except for Native Americans, never did. They always thought of it as a meat for a savage. And so the basic deal with whaling in this country was you'd kill them for the whale oil and the whale bone or the baleen, and you'd throw away the carcass.
How soon after people started coming here from Europe did whaling begin?
The coolest thing is that it tracks American history right literally from the beginning. There were reports from people on the Mayflower seeing right whales kind of frolicking off the bow of the Mayflower when it came in 1620. So right away, people understood. John Smith had seen it. There was a 100-mile-wide swath of right whales that would migrate up and down the east coast of the North America. And they knew right away these were valuable critters, and they started, you know, by 1630, they were doing drift whaling, where you just kind of, you know, capture a stranded whale and process it on the beach. And then that developed into shore whaling, where you'd get out in little boats and go through the surf and kill them. And finally, they'd killed off so many right whales that the whaling we think of, the really hardcore whaling, which is done from ships way out at sea with deep water, dangerous, highly intelligent whales, sperm whales. That began by about 1710, 1720, and Nantucket very quickly became the center of this really unbelievable, extreme enterprise.
Now, why whale oil? After all, you get tallow from other animal fats, and they're much more accessible, aren't they?
Well, whale oil...
And not so difficult to kill?
Whale oil was the premium illuminant. It burned more brightly, it burned whiter, it burned sootless, and it burned odorless. You know, Benjamin Franklin was absolutely his preferred illumination. So in terms of private consumption in homes, by the mid-18th century, it was the kind of the middle, upper middle class illuminant of choice. It also was used in lighting the streets of London. I mean, as soon as the Americans got into the business, their main market was London. In 1736, London, huge urban crime problem, all these people flooding in off the lands with the enclosures, and they wanted to light the streets at night to try to bring down the crime. How did they light it? Whale oil, because of the brightness and the whiteness of it. And it was originally so expensive, it was always quite expensive, that really it was municipalities like London that could afford to buy it in abundance.
You say it began with drift whaling and then shore whaling. Was it as dangerous as it later became when these huge ships went out to try to find the whales?
You know, there were more ways to die when you're on a ship for 3 or 4 years. But nevertheless, the primal encounter, 5-6 guys in a rowboat attacking a 60, 70, 80-ton enraged mammal at point-blank range with a piece of sharpened iron, that didn't change. So at the point of contact where you were trying to kill the animal, there was no more lethal or dangerous occupation. You know, you go out and you spend that long, 2, 3, 4 years on a boat, then health problems, weather issues become much more problematic as well.
Was Nantucket the center because the whales liked the waters off Nantucket?
Exactly. I mean, Nantucket was right in the middle of that 100-mile-wide swath of migrating whales. And so it was a kind of a you could think of it as like an oil rig right out there, right in the middle of where oil-rich whales were kind of floating profit centers kind of funneling by them.
But it could have been Montauk.
It could have been, and it was Montauk, but it was Nantucket that was farthest out in the stream and had the really the healthiest right whale fishery going. It was then also Nantucket that fortuitously in the early 18th century pioneered sperm whaling. There's an apocryphal story of a captain who kind of was blown all out to sea in a whaleboat and found a sperm whale. And the thing about the sperm whales is they're the whales with the most precious whale oil. They have these huge head cases in which was spermaceti oil, which is this viscous substance, clear as vodka until it hits the air, and then it turns a kind of a milky semen color, which is what people thought it was sperm, and hence the name sperm whale. But it was really the discovery of the sperm whale off Nantucket, about 15 miles off the coast in the 17-teens, that really spearheaded it, really gave it tremendous impetus to this enterprise.
Well, if this was so valuable, I assume other people wanted to get into the act.
They did. And the Brits were always enraged and systematically ever more enraged across the 18th century that here this little colonial outpost, its American colonies, was beating them regularly at their own game of whaling. And they decried the fact that it was happening. And the fact is the Brits always paid their whalemen, you know, by the hour. From the beginning, there was a kind of a good old American attitude, which is like, let's cut everybody, give everybody a share of the profits. It was called a lay. So if you were on an American whale ship, you had a stake, literally, in the outcome of the voyage. And I think that would partly contributed to the success, but not only.
But you say that as time went on, the ships got bigger. And we're talking about a lot of men on some of these ships. So how
30,
much of
36?
Yeah, how much of a cut could they get?
Well, in the middle 18th century, before the Revolution, it might have been 1/75th for an enlisted guy, so to speak. By the middle 19th century, by what was called the Golden Age, just before it tanked completely, you know, the average forecastle whaleman got about 1/175th or 1/200th of the profits. I mean, by that time, it was essentially a Dickensian sweated industry where the only ways you could make the profits really work, make the numbers work, was to sweat your labor right down to the bone.
How many whales would a typical catch be?
You know, 80, 70, 60.
Oh, that many?
Yeah, it would depend exactly. You know, if you had an 80-ton sperm whale, you would have a huge yield of whale oil, both from the blubber and the head case. But if it were a 25, 30-ton sperm whale, I mean right whale, you wouldn't get that much. So it was a very, very – the mathematics of it was very, very tricky. And making it work, you know, was an absolutely complicated algebra that makes CDOs, I think, look like, you know, ABC.
Well, how do they fit these huge mammals onto the ships? They must have thrown some of it overboard.
They threw almost all of it overboard. And what they would do is they'd tow the dead animal, if they were fortunate enough to kill it, back to the ship, sometimes 5 or 10 miles. And they'd attach it to the side of the ship – hoist up pieces of blubber called blanket pieces, which were 5 feet wide, which they would use the whale's own body to kind of unpeel itself. And when they had about a 1-ton piece of blanket, they would cut it off, cut that into smaller pieces, throw it into the tri-works, bring it down to oil, actually use the cracklings, which were the leftover bits of, you know, de-oiled blubber to actually fuel the furnace. So it was just, and the scenes on board the ship, I mean, it's not just Melville, it's anybody who ever went on board one of these ships, which was a factory ship as well as a hunting ship, would describe the in lurid detail the kind of the murderous look of the decks of a whale ship.
So some people were hunting the whale, others were processing the whale that they'd already caught, they'd shoot a harpoon at the whale. Was it over once the harpoon went into the whale?
The harpoon is not the killing instrument. The harpoon is meant to pin you to a whale. It attaches a boat to a whale, and then it's the weight of that boat as the whale takes off that exhausts the mammal.
Because the whale starts pulling the boat.
It was called a Nantucket sleigh ride, and it could go up. It was basically as fast as you could go in the late 18th century, 25 miles an hour sometimes, skimming over the surface with a guy in front of the boat with a hatchet ready to cut the cord should the sperm whale decide to sound. But if it didn't, it would finally tire itself out, and at that point, they would pull themselves closer, and in this primal scene, kill the whale by basically chopping up the coiled arteries around the lungs so that it couldn't breathe. And you knew you had been successful when this huge geyser of blood came funneling out of the spout. They called it fire in the chimney, and that was basically the end of the whale.
My guest is Rick Burns, whose latest film is called Into the Deep, America, Whaling, and the World. It premieres tonight. What time?
9 o'clock.
Here in New York on Channel 13. We're talking about how terrible this was for the whale. It was also terrible. I'm not trying to defend whalers here because something happened. I don't know when it happened, but we've gone from thinking whaling was a heroic profession to thinking that it's an awful thing. And the United States, people in this country generally seem to love whale and condemn whalers in other countries.
An attitude of very, very recent origin. I mean, up until 150 years ago, as Graham Burnett, wonderful historian at Princeton, pointed out for our film, you know, basically everything we ate, everything we wore, almost everything we lived in or around in human societies was extracted from nature at enormous cost of suffering and destruction to animals. And that's just the nature. And people didn't, you know, people up until 150 years, until John Muir, until Henry David Thoreau, until Melville, we didn't live in a culture in which you had the luxury to stop and wonder, what the hell is this doing to the resource that we're depleting?
But they must have been aware of the fact that they were depleting that resource because it started with the whales that passed by Nantucket, and then they disappeared and they had to go further and further afield. It must have occurred to somebody, you know, if we're successful at this for a fairly long period of time, we're not going to have any more whales.
You know, by the 1840s, by the 1850s, by around the time of Darwin, people began to connect the dots and understand what they had known for a century, century and a half, which is, as you say, that they were depleting the resource on which the industry was dependent. But they were really more concerned initially with the impact on the industry. And it was really not until the mid-19th century that this thought that there might be something valuable in and of itself about whales as a creature began to dawn on people.
Earlier in the 19th century, in 1819, you tell the story of the Essex. Mm-hmm. Was this a famous story at the time?
It was. The Essex was the most notorious event of American whaling. A Nantucket ship, 20 guys on it, that went out in August of 1819 and never returned. 3,000 miles off the coast of Chile, struck not once but twice by a bull sperm whale and sunk.
So some of the sperm whales recognized that these ships were a danger to them.
You know, the marine biologist Michael Moore has pointed out, when you ask the question, how intelligent is a whale, he comes sadly to the conclusion, not intelligent enough, because if more sperm whales had realized that basically even a 300-ton ship was no match for an enraged 70- or 80-ton bull, there might not have been an American whaling industry for very long. These cases were few and far between, and the Essex was absolutely the most spectacular.
Was it typical for a ship at this point to have to sail all the way around the bottom of South America to find whales?
It had just gotten to that point. That kind of centrifugal direction of the industry had reached by the 1790s and the first couple decades of the 19th century had reached out into the Pacific, and the Essex was one of the first ships that went far out, 3,000 miles off Chile.
How much of the detail do we know? Do we know if the men on the ship provoked that whale?
Well, we know that we know a lot because there were 8 survivors. Many of them left accounts behind, and we know that they were out sperm whaling, that it was a beautiful day, that they'd gone into a pod of sperm whales, and that the bull of that pod, one of the largest whales any of them had ever seen, clearly took exception to their aggression and turned on the ship not once but twice. Sank it. The 20 guys got off, and there began a 93-day Donner Party at sea in which those who were fortunate enough to survive did so by eating those who were less fortunate.
I'm assuming that Moby Dick is a pretty accurate description of what the life of a whaler was.
The great writer Nat Philbrick, who wrote a wonderful account of the Essex, and whose father, Thomas Philbrick, was a Melville scholar.
Is going to be on our show this week to talk about his latest book.
Incredible book, The Last Stand, about Custer and Sitting Bull. But, you know, as Nat puts it, the entire DNA of the American sperm whale fishery is there in Moby Dick. And you can really, you could, as he put it, take that book to a distant planet and reconstruct the industry. It's a remarkable, I think actually unparalleled, kind of core sampling of an American industry.
He started off on a whaling ship called the Acushnet. Why that name?
The Acushnet River comes down into New Bedford, and it is the waters that flow into the Sound at New Bedford. And he'd come there at 20, 21, had no idea what he wanted to do, kind of unemployed surveyor and school teacher, did what kids did when they didn't know what they wanted to do in 1840, which is they went whaling. And he found himself, and this is one of the things I just find so stunning and moving about whaling and the whaling story. There's Melville 20 years after the Essex sinks, 3,000 miles off the coast of Chile himself, and he happens to meet another whale ship, and on that whale ship there happens to be the son of the surviving first mate, who hands young Herman Melville a copy of his father's ghost-written account, The Extraordinary Disaster of the Essex. And Melville wrote at the time, he said, you know, the impact on me of reading this account, so far from land and so close to where the ship sank, had a startling impact on me. And there we see, it's rare in literary history, you kind of see Moby Dick as an imaginative construct come surging out of the Pacific.
Well, how long was Melville a whaler before he started writing writing down his daily activities with the thought of writing novels?
Well, you know, he spent 3-4 years at sea, came back in 1844, fired with ambition to be a writer.
Moby Dick is until 1851.
He wrote a couple of very conventional novels based on his South Sea wanderings, Umu and Typee, bestsellers. He now had a little bit of money, retired to the Berkshires with his wife and son, and began to write this story, which was based on this account that was burning a hole in his imagination, the story of the whale that sank the ship.
It's amazing that two of the greatest writers, Joseph Conrad and Herman Melville, started off just as sailors, and because of those their experiences, wound up writing great novels. Not initially either. It took Conrad a few books before he really hit his stride. What was the response of the whaling community when Moby Dick was published in 1851?
What's so wonderful about the story from a narrative point of view is that, you know, Melville's out there at the very peak just before the end of whaling, and he knows he's seeing everything about America and humanity in the whaling industry, and he writes this book which he's sure is going to be his magnum opus. And whaling tanks, and the novel goes to the bottom of the ocean. No one likes it. They think it's wild. Some people say, well, you know, one reviewer says, you know, the Ahab part's a little extraneous. It's a good kind of technical account of whaling. And it was a tremendous blow to Melville, who in some important sense as a writer never really recovered from the devastation that his great masterpiece was unrecognized.
Did whaling end because it was replaced by petroleum?
I think in large part there was, you know, many factors, of course, played a role. Some of it was that, you know, the American whaling merchants didn't have the stomach to continue. I mean, people went on to make money after that in whaling. But, you know, the Macy's of Nantucket or the Folgers of Nantucket, they didn't want to recapitalize a new kind of industry. They went into retail on Main Street or providing coffee for gold miners, and that was really the end. But it was petroleum, 1859, Western Pennsylvania, that really spelled the end.
Although there still are whalers out there. And there are people who searched for whales in hopes of collecting ambergris. Do they still collect ambergris to make perfume?
They do. It still rolls up. My question is, who the hell figured out that the extract of the irritation of the bowels of the sperm whale, God knows.
Vomit, in effect.
Yeah, or even more intimate. And that this secreted substance would become an invaluable, worth more than gold, sort of substance used in making perfume, because it helps anything that smells smell that way for a longer period of time. So it's a fixative in perfume. I love human beings for figuring out that essentially the excretion of a whale's anus is going to make a useful product for royalty.
At least you don't have to kill the whale to get it. Do the whales go to the Gulf of Mexico? Would they have
they do.
Be affected by this oil spill?
They do, and one of the really extraordinary people that consulted for our film and talked to us on camera, Michael Moore at Woods Hole, pointed out the other night something which I found extremely poignant, which is that they're now going to target sperm whales in the Gulf to see what the impact of rogue petroleum is on these populations of sperm whales. So yesterday's illuminant is going to be understood through today's illuminant in this ghastly juxtaposition, which, you know, somehow,
very ironic, but
very ironic. Somehow we're afloat on a sea of oil one way or the other.
Although there aren't all that many sperm whale around these days, are there?
You know, it's a very complicated situation. Sperm whales bounce back. You know, we didn't hunt them to extinction. We killed maybe 250,000 in the 19th century out of maybe 2 or 3 million. You know, so it's a complicated thing.
Rick Burns, Into the Deep, America, Whaling, and the World, will be broadcast tonight at 9 p.m. on Channel 13 here in New York and on PBS stations around the country. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me, Leonard.